The Tom Woods Show, episode 1188.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Homeschooling parents, it's going to be time to start thinking about next year before you know it. Let me recommend to you the self-taught Ron Paul curriculum, which I've been using with my daughters. It's going to preserve your mental health while it gives them a top-notch education. Plus, get $160 worth of free bonuses when you use my link, ronpaulhomeschool.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. We're back with Gene Epstein once again. Gene, as many of you know, is recently retired from Barron's, the nation's premier financial publication. And he is the director of the Soho Forum, which we'll have an opportunity to say something about in just a moment. But we want to talk about some themes raised in Brian Kaplan's book, The Case Against Education. I've had Brian on to talk about that book. But Gene's review raises a number of other issues and some further supporting arguments. And, well, frankly, it's always nice to have a chance to talk to Gene. And I knew he would have wonderful, great, bold, and iconoclastic ideas about this. So that's what we're going to talk about today. Remember, you can grab Brian's book, The Case Against Education, through Amazon. You can get it through my link to Amazon at tomwoods.com/1188. And the Audible version is available as well. You can get that for free if you've not yet joined Audible. You can get that at tomwoodsaudio.com. Gene, welcome back.
Good to be back, Tom. And I'm looking forward to talking about our topic today.
We always start off with a little word about the Soho Forum. Let's hold that off for later because it looks like your next event, which is early July, is already sold out between Eric Voorhees and Peter Schiff.
It is indeed, although I'm eager to announce our special event that we just set up on August 27th. We are getting, it's a dubious honor but we are getting our first Nobel Prize winner to come. That's Joseph Stiglitz. And he will be having a conversation with William Easterly about what's the best route out of global poverty, the free market or government. And I think it's going to be a pretty dramatic evening, August 27th. And we posted it several days ago when we're already selling big time for it. But I really would love your listeners to come because I will be moderating. And Easterly and Stiglitz, their feet will be held to the fire about this issue, about free markets or government in bringing us out of global poverty.
That's such a great topic, absolutely great topic. And I'm familiar with both folks. And I think there's no way that's not going to be punchy and exciting. So thesohoforum.org is the website. Definitely get over there. Is your offer still good? I won't mention it if you don't want to do it.
For you, Tom, it's still good. Tom's daughter, the inside story. Tom's daughter came, and she is lovely. And the first words out of her mouth were Tom Woods. I said, "Oh wow, more money spent." And then you plied people back to it. But no, the offer's still good. Tom Woods. Okay. Say the word Tom Woods, and you get a free drink at the bar.
Yeah, you got to seek out Gene Epstein to do that. You tell him my name, and you get yourself a free drink, which we did.
You did.
I got one. Regina got one. That was very. In fact, I think Regina said to you something like, "Gene Epstein, there's one thing I've always wanted to say to you.
That's right.
It's Tom Woods."
Exactly.
So, anyway, yeah, that was a lot of fun. That was the one on the Constitution where Judge Napolitano was the guest moderator, and Dave Smith, who opens these with comedy, was so on that night. He was so great that even though he's very edgy, even a respectable guy like Randy Barnett just could not hold it together listening to Dave do his routine.
No, Randy loved him, and Mark Skousen then asked for his address. He wants to invite him to Freedom Fest. I don't know if he got Dave to do that. I told him, Dave's going to be a father in December, so his schedule is tight. But indeed, Dave is great, and we have him again for August. We're booking him every time. Happily, luckily for us, we're only several blocks away from Dave's studio, so he can give us his 9 minutes of stand-up almost every Soho Forum event. He will be there August 27th. As well for the face-off between Stiglitz and Bill Easterly.
Well, that sounds great. I hope there's some way I can make it as well. All right, let's jump into our topic.
Yeah, sure.
I've had Brian Kaplan on to talk about his book, The Case Against Education. Yes. You wrote a review of it for, I guess, the Manhattan Institute, and I'll link to that on the show notes page. And I want to get into some of your thoughts because you're definitely adding to the conversation here.
Thanks.
And you have more to say than is even in that column. So
yes.
We'll get to the more radical stuff a little bit later. But let's stay on a basically consequentialist level, which is where most people are on education. Because even if you could argue that from a rights point of pay for somebody else's education, people would still feel like, well, yeah, that.
Yes.
Brian makes a pretty darn strong case, as he did at your Soho Forum. I thought he was a very effective debater at that event.
Yes.
And he comes at it from a lot of different angles. He's looked at all the studies. He's looked at survey results. And in other words, what he's arguing in effect that what we believe about education and what it can accomplish is based on a series of propositions that are based in almost nothing.
Mm-hmm.
That there really isn't anything backing up these things that everybody knows, we all think we know,
mm-hmm.
but actually none of these things are true.
Mm-hmm.
So let's start off with maybe like a bird's eye overview of the problem here,
yeah.
which is education is expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like people need education in order to be successful. Therefore, without state involvement, people will not be able to be prosperous. They won't have opportunities. Inequalities in society will persist or grow. How do you just start from there to put people's minds at ease that you don't need the current system to accomplish these things?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, as a matter of fact, I want to first of all acknowledge, Tom, that you have already covered this ground in so many great ways, not just with Brian. But I especially liked in the Education Without the State collection of interviews, the first one with Sheldon Richman, who pretty eloquently points out that if we simply separated the education from the state, we'd have no problem educating poor people. It's not just, as Brian, oh, actually, and Sheldon both point out, that there was already a very high literacy rate in the U.S. when the government got into the school system, not just as you actually had these very striking interviews about schools in poor countries and really poor countries where the poor people in this country, of course, are fabulously rich compared to those people in poor countries like India, and yet there's this amazing network of schools. So I do highly recommend Education Without the State, your own collection. So we're talking to a libertarian audience, and Brian, of course, addresses the audience in different ways. He does indeed favor the complete separation of education and state, and points out that to the extent that we have an education system that actually prepares people for work or for the real world, it does maybe 20%. Of our school system does that. You know, that 20%, of course, consists of teaching people basic math, reading and writing, to the extent that it does that, although it does a horrible job of that. But, you know, he says, well, you know, it obviously does it to some degree. And then it does have some courses and vocational courses, as well as science courses that prepare some people for the world of work. But by and large, about 80% of the education system, learning French, Latin, Spanish, learning social studies, things that most people even forget, it's a complete waste. Now, why is it a complete waste? Brian would say consequentially, and of course you and I would agree, it's a complete waste because it's resisted. It's lost on most of those kids. Most of the kids are not ready for it. They're not about to lead the life of the mind. And so the day after the exam, they pretty much forget it all. Even if you're going to make a case that this is just wonderfully wonderful uplift to teach kids the history of ancient Egypt or whatever else, or how to learn French, the schools fail, actually, and based upon all the tests that are given to older people, what do they know about the Constitution? What do they know about how many senators there are in each state? It turns out that the school system completely fails, even on its own terms, in teaching them all this stuff. And so in a strictly utilitarian way, the government is spending more than $1 trillion a year on college, high school, elementary school, and the money gets us nowhere. And then, of course, the next part of it is, well, why is it, however, that if you get a college education or if you get a high school education, that you earn more if you have a high school education than a high school dropout does, or you earn more if you have a college degree than a high school graduate does? And that's because of the phenomenon of signaling, which is not original with Brian, but he takes it to a new level. He points out that the premium that college graduates make or high school graduates make is based upon the fact that not that there's any content that you've gotten from your schooling. By and large, the content is only about 20%. And of course, for most college graduates, they already knew how to read and do sums by the time they graduated from high school, most of them anyway. It's really that you're signaling to employers, most crucially, not just that you're smart, because then they could give you some kind of IQ test, but also that you're diligent and that you're a good team player. As Brian would point out, if you have a college degree and some other person's a dropout, an employer is considering you, all other things being equal, why would the employer want to employ the dropout? The dropout could be an uncooperative person, he didn't play by the rules, so it's already a mark against him. And so college signals to employers, and employers pay nothing for this very expensive service. That's the other key point. It signals to employers that you have the ability to conform and that you're diligent. And those qualities then are conveyed by going to college. However, of course, from the standpoint of society, we're spending over $1 trillion for nothing, because we could just roll it all back. It's a very, very expensive way for people to signal that they have a job. If we abolished it all and rolled it all back, then employers would probably have to spend some money on internships. They would sort people out in fairer ways through internships, apprenticeships. People would have the money. If they didn't have to pay all that money for schooling, they would have the money to send their kids to these internships and apprenticeships, and the labor market would be sorted out that way. So I think that more or less summarizes the consequentialist argument. It's the analogy. The best analogy is if everybody stands up in the theater, nobody sees any better. We might as well all not go to the effort and all sit down and forgo and not spend this fortune of money, over $1 trillion that the government spends on schooling.
Can you say a word about your approach when you were teaching, because you took a unique approach with regard to attendance and so on?
Yeah. Well, as a matter of fact, this now begins to get into my own hobby horse about the whole thing. You know, I was educated about the problems of education by writers who may be familiar to you, Tom, but even perhaps not to you. Paul Goodman, John Holt, who wrote How Children Fail, James Herndon, who wrote How to Survive in Your Native Land, A.S. Neal. There was actually a whole lot of left-leaning people in their politics and most other ways who taught me about the waste and the oppression of education long before Brian came along. And so when I became a college instructor in economics, I was already convinced that this was oppression, this was a waste, that the cowed look I got from my students in freshman economics was indicated that as soon as the final exam was over, they'd forget everything I taught them. And so by the second semester of my teaching, I made this announcement that anybody who merely signed up for the class would get an automatic C. You'd get an automatic pass, and I never had to see you again. But I had to make some concession to the system. So in order to get a B or an A, you did have to do the work. You did have to show up. By the way, I taught at Sydney University 2 years later, and there I liked it better. The grades were just H, P, and F, you know, pass or an honors. So I could give, I would give guaranteed passes to the students. And of course, the signups for my classes soared. And nobody snitched to the administration about what I was doing. I clearly would have been fired had I been caught. And then I got about a 10% attendees. It was depressing to see all those empty rows of seats, but at least the 10% who actually did show up looked a little, they smiled, they looked a little bit more eager. Although, as I say, even then, of course, they were there to earn the grade. Some of them wanted the A or the B or the honors, so I had to make some compromise. But certainly, it indicated that if you just tell them, look, you don't have to show up, you can pass the course, 90% of them are going to vote with their feet and leave. Now, of course, maybe I was just an uninspiring teacher, but then I use a quote from Brian's own book about the professor. Why am I forgetting his name? The Harvard professor, in any case, who is a great lecturer, who says that at Harvard, only 50% of the class ever shows up for his lectures, and that Harvard students just exit in droves from their courses. Bill Gates revealed that he cut all his classes when he was at Harvard. So even at the institutions of really high learning, the life of the mind is just not appropriate for most 20-year-olds. You even read that in Plato. He didn't think that real wisdom, real education should start until you're past the age of 30. But then, of course, I had to exit teaching because eventually I would have been caught. I couldn't continue my career as a college professor giving guaranteed passes. This kind of subversive activity would eventually have come to light. And then I vowed, however, in a way, I guess you followed a similar trajectory, Tom. I vowed that I would never face a room full of people as a lecturer or in any other way unless they were there voluntarily. And here I've got the SOA Forum where people are actually paying to come. Voluntarily paying to come and sticking around. So that's my principle, which is that I want to face a voluntary audience, not a group of people who are being forced into coming. And now they are being forced into coming because they know that unless they pass the course and get the degree, many, or not all, but many of the good jobs are not going to be available to them. They're not going to be able to get most professional jobs, lawyer, doctor, engineer. None of those jobs will be available to them unless they pass these courses. And that sort of segues into my feeling about rights. Because Brian, interestingly enough, when he was arguing the issue at the SOA Forum, he said, look, we're all libertarians. And he then said, the government is taking our money to finance this super expensive education system. If it's going to take our money, he said, it bears a very heavy burden of proof to show that it's doing some good with this money. And then Brian said, it's not even close. They're not doing any good with this money. It's 80 to 90% a waste. So he was right about that part of it. But the part that Brian left out is that we as libertarians also have to question whether children or young people have any rights. I mean, this, by the way, I recommend The Ethics of Liberty by Murray Rothbard, in which he has a whole chapter on the rights of young people and the rights of parents to take care of their young people. But the one thing that's obvious to a libertarian like Murray Rothbard, and obvious, of course, to me, and hopefully to you too, Tom, is that this is a system in which you go to prison if you're under the age of 16, unless you attend class. That's truancy. But true to his usual calling, Rothbard actually documents kids who are actually in prison, in juvie, as they call it, because they didn't want to go to school. And then the other part of it is that it's unlawful for a kid to get a job who's under the age of 16, again, the child labor laws. And so those two things are clearly trampling on the rights of young people, and it's part of the system, part of this whole bureaucratic system run by the government that suppresses the rights, that oppresses young people. And I do believe that as libertarians, we ought to recognize how offensive that is. But beyond that as well, it's not just the compulsory education up to 16, but it's also that because over $1 trillion is spent by college, by government, to monopolize high school and college, the bar is raised, and you do have to go to college because otherwise you can't get a decent job. Roll all of that back, and you will have private sector colleges. True, you will have some high school and some other things, but by and large, we will return to a situation in which you can become a Rockefeller or a Ford or any of the or a Carnegie or indeed Bill Gates or any of those other people and not attend school at all and get a decent job or Abraham Lincoln for that matter. Then we will have a level playing field. And by the way, a much fairer playing field for poor people. I met with Brian before the debate, and I told him, he has a much more powerful libertarian message than he seems to think. Brian reacted by saying, well, but look at what most parents do. Most parents oppress their kids also with school. And I said, you're right about that, but just because other parents have drunk the Kool-Aid and think of it as their church doesn't mean that the state is not doing it to us. The state is clearly at the root of this problem. And if we separate the state from the school system, we will have a much more just society. And again, I emphasize, a much fairer society to poor people. Because poor people are, to some, many poor people, are not, they don't have kids, so they're having to pay for this education system. And then so many of those working class people who do have kids who never go to college, are having to pay for the college education of richer folk. So really, egalitarians should support this idea as well, the separation of school and state.
Let's leave aside the rights question and let's get to what somebody would come back with. Yeah. With something like that, they would say, I look at the average 18-year-old and the idea that he has any idea what's good for him or what coursework he ought to take or what knowledge is beneficial for him as a human being is laughable. So yes, we do need to have a, quote, system that more or less dictates to him, look, we have thousands of years of accumulated wisdom in this civilization, and you're a knucklehead 18-year-old. You're not going to tell us what knowledge is valuable. We're going to tell you. Now, why is that wrong?
First of all, you do indeed get into the interesting question of the rights of young people and the way in which their behavior is curbed or not curbed. To begin with, we have parents. Who no longer have to pay those sky-high taxes, no longer have to go deeply into debt to send their kids to college, who then have an awful lot of money freed up to channel their kids into the areas where they think their kids should go. I trust the parents far more than I trust the state. So the parents pay the bills, the parents will tell those kids where to go. Beyond that, I believe that what will inevitably happen, of course, is that kids will be offered a menu of choices, by the way, when they're 13. I'm calling it the Bar Mitzvah plan. You're a man, you're a woman at the age of 13, or the Bat Mitzvah plan. At the age of 13, most kids will be literate. They'll be able to read and write. And their parents, of course, will make sure that they are. The parents will cajole them. The parents have the right to say, look, if you want to go out and play, then you have to spend a couple of hours this morning learning how to be literate, learning how to do sums. Even if it doesn't occur to you, it's a good idea. And then by the time they're 13, the parents will tell them that you have various options now. We can send you into this apprenticeship or that apprenticeship. It did exist. They did have parents. This did indeed exist. There were indeed people, immigrant kids, Lincoln, others, who managed to find their way in society guided by their parents. That's the situation we'll revert to. What's wrong with that? What's the problem? Do we really think that the state bureaucracies know better than the kids' parents where the kid should be channeled into, what the kids' interests are? And by the way, some kids will indeed, want to pursue what is more or less similar to a formal education. Some kids will indeed want to study Latin and study philosophy. Some kids will. The vast majority of young people, however, for them it's not suitable. For many of us, by the way, by the time we're 40 or 50 or 60, we become more reflective and we want to read books and we want to lead more of the life of the mind. So it will all be sorted out that way. But again, the answer to those who are concerned about those misguided 18-year-olds is that they do have parents.
Gene, it so happens that one of the sponsors of my show happens to be an excellent illustration of exactly what we're talking about, how you can learn outside the traditional school environment. So I've been promoting Skillshare for quite a while, which I'm doing right this moment. And as a matter of fact, not too long ago, one of my daughters said that she was interested in learning computer animation. So my first thought was, well, let's go to Skillshare and see what classes they have on that, because they've got over 20,000 classes covering a wide range of skills that you might want to learn to advance your career, to make yourself a more successful freelancer, to build your own business, whatever it is, Skillshare has got it. The array of courses is unbelievable. And a beautiful thing about it is you can join the millions of people already on Skillshare today with a special offer that's just for my listeners. Get 2 months of Skillshare for just 99 cents. That's right. Skillshare is offering Tom Wood Show listeners 2 months of unlimited access to over 20,000 classes for just 99 cents. So to sign up, go to Skillshare.com/Woods. Again, go to Skillshare.com/Woods to start your 2 months now. That's Skillshare.com/Woods. Let's talk about an issue that came up in Brian's debate with Professor Glaser of Harvard, who argued that Brian was underestimating the role of education in forming human capital. And he gave as evidence a number of countries he just said, look, rich countries happen to spend more in education than poor countries. And now he granted that doesn't necessarily prove that that's what made them rich. It could just be they get rich and then they have the money for education. But he says, I can name you very significant examples of countries that saw their economic growth take off in the wake of their increased spending on education. So that's at least highly suggestive. Yes. And you have your own way of responding to that argument. So what is that?
Yeah, no, indeed. That was where Brian basically did win that debate. He picked up a number of points, and Ed Glaser stayed at his initial vote and his final vote were the same. So I do think that by and large, Brian did an excellent job debating Ed Glaser. And Ed, Ed, by the way, is also a libertarian fellow traveler, was being very honest and respectful of many of Brian's points. So I think I do recommend that your listeners go into the soulforum.org and listen to the entire debate. But Brian, I think, had more difficulty than I would have had in parrying Ed Glaser's point, because Ed actually cited Singapore, for example, and China and places of that sort, where he said you can show that they started to invest in education and then the growth took off. But he chose exactly those cases in which the Economic Freedom Index took off. It was already completely explained in the case of China by the fact that in 1978 there was massive market liberalization in China, that's when their growth started to take off. At the same time, they started to spend more on education. But overwhelmingly, the Chinese success, to the extent that hundreds of millions did climb out of poverty, the Economic Freedom Index more than explains it. Same thing with Singapore. Singapore already started at a high level, but Singapore's Economic Freedom Index grew as well. And that's pretty much all you have to look at. And the Economic Freedom Index, of course, having to do with property rights, having to do with regulation of government, all of those things are so clearly causally related to growth Whereas, you know, there was actually an odd moment in which Brian said he disagreed with Glaser about Singapore, and Glaser shot back, well, being literate is important. Glaser actually misspoke because Brian pointed out, but they were already literate in most of these countries. They could already read in Singapore and China even. So Glaser had to concede that point. But Glaser then would have to be arguing, again, that the usual kind of argument, the causality between having to learn, you know, propagandistic history about your own country or any of the other courses that are taught when school you know, it gets more expensive, and how is that connected to economic growth or to the enhancement of human capital? So that's where Glaser's argument was causally weak. But again, in terms of the actual correlation in time, the much more powerful Economic Freedom Index explains it all quite well. Ed also is hung up Ed Glaser was hung up on the fact that in richer areas of the country, we spend more, of the U.S. rather, we spend more in education than in poorer areas. And there too, the reverse causation is pretty clear that, you know, rich areas just spend more on education. It's not really causally related. But his correlation really, in the case of countries like Singapore and China, didn't work at all. And that was really Ed Glaser's most powerful argument. But beyond that, I think that it was, again, a lively evening, and Brian did quite well. Although I do want to say that Brian, I've been fascinated with Brian's various confrontations with people. For example, he met when he had an interview with Russ Roberts of Econ Talk, very good show, Russ Roberts, one of my favorite podcasts. Russ, who I think is, for whom, of course, you know, to pick up on your line, you know, education is our church. I would put it in my own terms, education is our church and synagogue. People have this religious faith in it. Russ Roberts challenged Brian by saying, oh, well, you know, he did all this research on how, you know, people don't retain anything about the Declaration of Independence, and nobody knows, nobody can pass the simplest quiz about, you know, senators and congressmen or anything else. But how about all those intangible benefits that you get from going to school that are beyond measure, that you can't measure in a test? And Brian had some kind of response, but I would say, I mean, the easy way to respond is, how about all of those difficult to measure harm and killing of curiosity that you find in so many people who just, you know, I knew a kid when I was, we were both graduating from college. He said, I really hate history now. Or you're exposed to the novels of Willa Cather in high school, and you didn't want to read them then, and then they just leave a bad taste in your mouth ever since. And so all of the killing of curiosity that comes from forcing this schooling down kids' throats is also difficult to measure, and I wish Brian had cited that point. Another one, again, getting back to rights, Tom, if you forgive me, is that when he was at the Cato Institute, a lot of people were grandstanding about what a Philistine he is. You know, you, of course, have discussed this as well. You know, oh my God, don't you? You know, all you're talking about is how to prepare people for work. We're trying to create great citizens. You know, that's what schooling is all about. And so, but then, of course, it wasn't just, as Brian was able to say, that if you're creating great citizens, you're doing a bad job of it, because we have a pretty ignorant population of citizens about so much. But again, Brian should have responded and said, you know, is this the way you, somebody from the Cato Institute, wants to create great citizens, for teach kids that they've got that we have a right to force things down their throat? Teach kids that you have no say in your life, in the decisions that affect your life when you're 15, 16, 17, and 18, that we know best? Subject them to, throw them in prison if they don't go to school until the age of 16. Teach them that you've got to listen to this guy drone on because otherwise you cannot get a decent job. Yeah. I'll tell you another funny story, Tom. When I started school at the age of 5 and 6, I was so out of it that I literally thought that school actually was a prison. I thought it was a place that you go to where adults yell at you and they march you around. Part of my problem was I already knew how to read. I just learned it from signs in the street. I already pretty much knew my sums, so I didn't understand that they were supposed to teach you things. And I remember a classic moment in the second grade. I was 7 years old, and a teacher actually yelled at us, and then she said, "Now, I don't like to scold you." And do you know what my reaction was? but isn't this what you're supposed to do? But what do you mean you don't like to do this? But that's your job, scolding us. I really thought it was a place where grown-ups yell at you. And that was what school was all about. And it only came to me later that they're pretending to try to teach you things. So the oppression of school, I think, is something that we should always keep uppermost in our minds, that there are other ways, much better ways, to respect the rights of young people, to steer them into things they like to do, to give them a whole smorgasbord of choices. I'm trying to remember the guy, the speechwriter for Goldwater, the guy, remember the guy who, Brian Seitz, who he met, who's, I forget his name. You probably know the guy's name. But anyway, he gave his son, he called up all his friends, and he gave his son, he signed up his son for 2 weeks each to go to work for one of his friends to get a taste of what the world of work is all about. And he said, that's really what kids want to talk about. That kids, you know, their testosterone is energetic. They don't want to sit. Most kids don't want to sit all day and read books and listen to lectures. Most kids want to be out there doing things. And there's a whole world out there that could open up for them in terms of apprenticeships and internships that could be a much more exciting way for them to live and could give them and respect their rights to choose in negotiation with their parents how they want to steer their efforts. I spent a summer swabbing latrines and setting up the stage at a summer theater, an equity summer theater in Rye, New York, and I had a much better time, sweeping floors and actually swabbing latrines and just being around plays and being around theater and listening to lectures, because that was part of the deal of being an apprenticeship, than I had going to school. I was a child laborer doing that sort of work when I was 15. I had much more fun doing that than I had going to school.
I think the guy you had in mind, by the way, was Carl Hess.
Carl Hess, exactly.
Who sent his, which is a very interesting kind of experiment.
Yeah, yeah.
Let me think about other. I mean, you've got so much interesting stuff in your article, by the way. Just things like, if somebody wants to go into medicine, why don't you just let them do it?
Oh, yeah.
Why do they have to go through the rigmarole? Like, what is the relationship between studying Shakespeare and going to medical school? And I'm not saying that it's not worthy, but it would be like me saying, you have to play tennis before you can go to medical school. The things don't seem related to me, or that you're going to learn how to learn by doing these things. As you noted, the evidence for this is extremely thin.
Yes.
I'm completely in sympathy with all that. And I say that as somebody who feels like there is plenty of merit in learning these things and being exposed to great literature and all that. But even as somebody like me who favors that and thinks that's a very good use of your time, at the same time, they've been trying to push this on everybody for a long time, and it just doesn't work. It doesn't actually work. Most people remember nothing of any of the Shakespeare they read, other than they did everything they could to get out of it, to read the Cliff Notes, to do whatever. The last thing in the world they want to do was this. And so likewise, when you're trying to tell 16-year-olds they really need to be reading Aristotle, this is not a good use of anybody's time. Almost no 16-year-old is going to connect with that. They're just going to walk away saying philosophy is really boring and a waste of everybody's time. So especially given that we live in the internet age, where you can get access to not only the original documents, but to commentaries on them, to lectures, to full-blown courses for nothing with the click of a mouse, anybody who at one point or another in his life says, I really need to go back and look at such and such, has the easiest entry point for doing that anyone could have imagined ever.
That's right, Tom. But it's funny, Tom, that here you are, a rock-ribbed libertarian just like me, and you prefer to play the consequentialist card. I guess I'll tell you one reason. Let's put it this way, in terms of an irony. Let's say that I'm forcing a kid to read Murray Rothbard and Ethics of Liberty, and the kid comes across the chapter about not throwing kids in prison for truancy or laws against them getting a job. I'm a contradiction in terms. I'm saying you have no rights, but I'm going to force you to read this thing that actually talks about how you do have rights. It's ridiculous. It's simply offensive to force a kid to do something for which there is simply no justification, because they think it's better for his soul. That's a presumption. John Holt, by the way, did write a book called The Rights of Children. They do have rights, and Rothbard talks about it as well. And I'll tell you another part of it, which is that we really have to go at both barrels, all cylinders, let's put it this way, in terms of our argument against those who have a religious conviction about school. They're going to rhapsodize about how, oh, don't you understand that you become a much better surgeon if you've read King Lear, if you're familiar with Hamlet, you know, and we, you know, we have to concede that's got to be true about somebody. You know, it's it may well be that, you know, you and I love learning. And by the way, so does Brian Kaplan. And certainly our souls have been enhanced by so much of what we've been exposed to in terms of what we wanted to read. But certainly, the idea that it's a one size fits all, and that everybody has to read Shakespeare. By the way, Brian was asked another challenging question from some other Cato people, by the way. Isn't it elitist to say that not everybody not everybody should read Shakespeare? Aren't you being elitist by saying that? And Brian did respond very well by saying, well, let's flip that around. Isn't it elitist to say that we have a right to force everybody to read Shakespeare? You know, I mean, of course, I would say it's more than just elitist. It's oppressive. Another story, which I like, is that Willa Cather wrote an educator who asked her, Willa Cather, the novelist. I know some people, Willa Cather's novels are indeed assigned in high school. Willa Cather was asked by an educator, what novels would you like, do you think are best for us to assign in high school of yours? And Willa Cather responded and said, please don't assign any of my novels in high school. I don't want my novels to be part of the grind. I'd really prefer to think that young people are reading my novels because they want to, and I don't want their curiosity about my novels to be killed by your forcing them into reading my novels. You know, so Willa Cather from the grave is saying, please don't force those kids to read my novels. It's not a good idea. I think we should all listen to Willa Cather. Probably William Shakespeare would have preferred the same thing. Please, you know, I sell tickets to my plays. William Shakespeare would have said, people come voluntarily. Don't force people to read my plays or to watch them.
I want to jump in just quickly on something you said about consequentialism and me. Yeah. I'm not saying that I'm impatient with arguments from rights. What I'm saying is that on education, given how, I don't know, I guess how much people are inclined to accept the current system and with a religious devotion, I think they would think arguments from rights, which are useful among libertarians on this issue, who might be a little bit squishy, are just too abstract. They said, look, even if I conceded your argument on rights, I still think we need this. There are some things that you can argue purely on rights, like for example, you know, surveillance and whatever. Like, there are some things government just can't do or should not be done to you, period, regardless of the consequences. But on this, given that people are convinced because of government propaganda that in the absence of this type of approach, everybody would be a moron and GDP would collapse and civilization would come to an end, I think you do have to show exactly what you are showing.
Oh, yes. No. I would even say that in the vast majority of cases, drug laws, you know, we want to use all we have. And we want to use consequentialism is almost always important. Absolutely. Certainly vital in this case. And rights, however, also are. In particular, of course, I found that Brian was responding to religious supporters, religiously motivated, faith-based supporters of education from people who actually are already libertarians. So to begin with, so therefore, just responding to these libertarians by invoking rights, I think, is important. But then in addition, however, if you actually look at, you know, when we talk about the drug laws, you know, the idea that somebody is in prison for, you know, we want to say, you know, to people, you know, you basically are saying that somebody who smokes pot should be in prison? Is that, that's the implication of what you're saying, that it should be unlawful. Similarly, Rothbard actually gets pretty grim. He talks about there are kids who actually are in detention because they didn't want to go to school. 15-year-olds 12-year-old kids, they didn't want to go to school. And so I think that even non-libertarians have to get their faces rubbed a little bit in that dirt. You know, kids who would like, I had a job I enjoyed doing, and if it paid anything, paid a salary, then it would have been unlawful. So those things, even non-libertarians are capable, I think, of responding to this point about the real implications of what compulsory schooling is all about and what the child labor laws are all about. But of course, I do agree with you that, however, the consequentialism is perhaps a more important argument in this case. Absolutely.
All right. Well, I think we'll wrap it up there. I'm going to urge people, of course, to read Brian's book, which you should do. We'll link to it at tomwoods.com/1188. There is an Audible version for all you folks who say you don't have time to read. You do have time to listen. I know that because you're listening to me right now. So you can get Brian's book on audio as well. You can get it for free through the Audible offer at tomwoodsaudio.com. And Gene, you were kind enough to mention one of my free ebooks, which is Education Without the State. You can grab a copy of that for nothing.
So let me also say, by the way, that your recent interview with Stephen Molyneux is also great. Of course, when you and Stephen Molyneux get together, just for the energy alone, it's fun to listen to. But certainly both of you guys were essentially pushing something worth considering, which of course is don't go to college at all. You know, Peter Thiel was, you know, commendably offering $100,000 to certain kids to drop out of college. All of that, by the way, is potentially a great idea. But probably for the vast majority of kids, the state has us in its grip. You know, you've got to get the degree. But anyway, that exchange you had with Stephen Molyneux was great.
And I appreciate that. Yeah, I have to bring extra energy to keep up with him. NoStateEducation.com. NoStateEducation.com is where you get my ebook. And we're going to link also at tomwoods.com/1188 to Gene's article on this. And bearing in mind that Gene's thoughts as expressed on this episode are more radical than you'll find in that article. That article has just got so many counterpoints to the kinds of arguments you hear that I think it's going to be really valuable for you. So, but also, as if I'm not throwing out enough links and violating all rules of podcasting here, I do want to remind people one final time about the Soho Forum.
Yeah,
if you live in the New York City area and you're not going to this thing on a regular basis, you're missing out on one of the great gems. One of the great, there are a lot of things that are annoying about living in New York City, and this helps to counter those. Because you say, well, on the other hand, I have the Soho Forum. So definitely check out the SohoForum.org. And Gene, thanks again for being here.
And say the words, Tom Woods, you get a free drink.
There you go. I forgot that part. Thanks, Gene.
Right, bye-bye.
All right, folks, here's a juicy one before I let you go. Here's a brand new podcast I think you guys may like. And of course, well, it's hosted by a listener of The Tom Woods Show, and it's theamericanhistorypodcast.com. That's the link, theamericanhistorypodcast.com, and you get two episodes a month, and each season of the show covers a specific topic. So what they're trying to do is take the myths of history, debunk them, and give you the real story. So the current season is season two, and it covers the war with Mexico. Season three is going to cover the Vietnam War. So far, he's got 28 episodes, and with a couple more coming almost as soon as I record this. So very, very much worth checking out, theamericanhistorypodcast.com. Of course, he's getting this nice shout-out because he used my link to get his web hosting through Bluehost, where you also get a discount because you know me. So a lot of reasons to do this. You get free publicity from me, you get a nice discount, you get some free tutorials from me, and you get membership in my private bloggers group, and of course, a link on my website. Lots of great reasons to do this. So if you're interested, you're going to be starting a site, check out tomwoods.com/publicity before you get started and find out how you get all these great bonuses that will help you get some traffic out of the gate. All right, that's it for today, everybody. See you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.